my side. Al Gore was a talented man and an accomplished politician. Like me, he had graduated from an Ivy League school and had a father in politics. But our personalities seemed pretty different. He appeared stiff, serious, and aloof. It looked like he had been running for president his entire life. He brought together a formidable coalition of big government liberals, cultural elites, and labor unions. He was plenty capable of engaging in class warfare populism. He was also vice president during an economic boom. He would be tough to beat. When I look back on the 2000 campaign, most of it collapses into a blur of handshaking, fundraising, and jousting for the morning headlines. There were two moments when the political merry-go-round stopped. The first came at the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia, which was managed well by Dad's former Deputy Chief of Staff and Transportation Secretary, Andy Card. I had attended every convention since 1976, but nothing compared to the feeling when I took center stage. I waited backstage in the dark, listening for the countdown. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Then out into the packed arena. At first, the scene was disorienting. Light and sound exploded all around me. I could feel the body heat and smell the people. Then the faces came into focus. I saw Laura and the girls, mother and dad. All my life, I had been watching George Bush speak. I was struck by the reversal of roles. Our opportunities are too great, our lives too short, to waste this moment, I said. So tonight, we vow to our nation we will seize this moment of American promise. We will use these good times for great goals. This administration had its moment. They had their chance. They have not led. We will. 2 months later, the campaigns paused again. This time, for the debates. Karen Hughes oversaw my preparation team, with Josh Bolton taking the lead on policy. Josh combines a brilliant mind, disarming modesty, and a buoyant spirit. I'll never forget standing at the Ames, Iowa straw poll in August 1999, watching several hundred motorcycles barrel into town. Among the riders were Governor Tommy Thompson of Wisconsin and Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell of Colorado. When the lead man hopped down from his shiny blue and chrome Iowa-made victory bike and pulled off his helmet, I was stunned to see Josh, clad in a bandana with our campaign logo. "Governor," he said, "meet the bikers for Bush." The first debate was in Boston. In the holding room backstage, I called Kirby John Caldwell, and we prayed over the phone. Kirby John asked the Almighty to give me strength and wisdom. His voice gave me such comfort and calm that I made the telephone prayer with Kirby John a tradition before major events for the rest of the campaign and during my presidency. The next voice I heard was that of the moderator, Jim Lehrer, of PBS, introducing the candidates. We emerged from our respective corners and met at center stage. Gore deployed the ultra-firm handshake. I suspected he was trying to play a head game, just like Ann Richards had in 1994. I concentrated on answering the questions, although at times I felt like I was on autopilot. By the time I glanced at my watch, which I had taken off and placed on the lectern to avoid repeating a debate mistake Dad had once made, we were almost done. We gave our closing statements, shook hands again, normal grip this time, and participated in the post-debate stage rush of family, friends, and aides. Immediately afterward, Karen told me Gore had made a big mistake. He had repeatedly sighed and grimaced while I was talking. That was news to me. I had been so focused on my performance that I had not noticed. The second and third debates had different formats but similar results. Neither of us made any quotable gaffes. There was one interesting moment in the third debate at Washington University in St. Louis. The town hall format gave us the freedom to roam the stage. The first question was about the patient's Bill of Rights. I was giving my answer when I saw Gore heading toward me. He is a big man, and his presence filled my space quickly. Was the vice president about to deliver a chest bump, a forearm shiver? For a split second, I thought I was back on the playground at Sam Houston Elementary. I gave him a look of amused disdain and moved on. I felt good about the debates. I believed my performance had exceeded expectations, and I figured the dramatic moments of the campaign were behind me. I was wrong. 5 days before the election, at a routine campaign stop in Wisconsin, Karen Hughes pulled me aside. We walked into a quiet room, and she said, "A reporter in New Hampshire called to ask about the DUI." My heart sank. Such negative news at the end of a campaign would be explosive. I had seriously considered disclosing the DUI 4 years earlier when I was called for jury duty. The case happened to involve drunk driving. I was excused from the jury because, as governor, I might later have to rule on the defendant's case as a part of the pardon process. As I walked out of the Austin courthouse, a reporter shouted, "Have you ever been arrested for DUI?" I answered, "I do not have a perfect record as a youth. When I was young, I did a lot of foolish things, but I will tell you this. I urge people not to drink and drive." Politically, it would not have been a problem to reveal the DUI that day. The next election was 2 years away, and I had quit drinking. I decided not to raise the DUI for one reason. My girls. Barbara and Jenna would start driving soon. I worried that disclosing my DUI would undermine the stern lectures I had been giving them about drinking and driving. I didn't want them to say, "Daddy did it, and he turned out okay, so we can too." Laura was traveling with me the day the press uncovered the DUI. She called Barbara and Jenna to tell them before they heard it on TV. Then I went out to the cameras and made a statement. I was pulled over. I admitted to the policeman that I had been drinking. I paid a fine, and I regret that it happened, but it did. I've learned my lesson. Not disclosing the DUI on my terms may have been the single costliest political mistake I ever made. Carl later estimated that more than 2 million people, including many social conservatives, either stayed home or changed their votes. They had been hoping for a different kind of president, someone who would set an example of personal responsibility. If I had it to do over, I would have come clean about the DUI that day at the courthouse. I would have explained my mistake to the girls and held an event with Mothers Against Drunk Driving to issue a strong warning not to drink and drive. All those thoughts ran through my head as I went to bed that night in Wisconsin. So did one more. I may have just cost myself the presidency. 5 days later, the 4-point lead I'd held before the DUI revelation evaporated. I campaigned frantically through the final week, and went into Election Day in a dead heat with Gore. That night, our extended family gathered for dinner at the Shoreline Grill in Austin. Toasts flowed freely until the exit polls started coming in. The networks called Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Florida for Gore. CBS anchor Dan Rather assured his viewers, "Let's get one thing straight right from the get-go. If we say somebody's carried a state, you can pretty much take it to the bank. Book it." Our guests, who did not know much about politics, continued to babble away. The night is young. Anything can happen. Those who understood the electoral map recognized I had just lost. Jeb and I were furious that the networks had called Florida before the polls closed in the Panhandle, the heavily Republican part of the state that lies in the central time zone. Who knew how many of my supporters had heard that news and decided not to vote? Laura and I slipped out of the dinner without touching our food. The car ride back to the governor's mansion was quiet. There isn't much to say when you lose. I was deflated, disappointed, and a little stunned. I felt no bitterness. I was ready to accept the people's verdict and repeat Mother's words from 1992. It's time to move on. Shortly after we got back, the phone rang. I figured this was the first of the consolation calls. You gave it your best shot. Instead, it was Carl. He didn't sound dejected. He sounded defiant. He was talking fast. He started spewing information about how the exit polls in Florida had overweighted this county or that precinct. I cut him off and asked for the bottom line. He said the projections in Florida were mathematically flawed. He then got on the telephone to the networks and screamed at the pollsters with the facts. Within 2 hours, he had systematically proved the major television networks wrong. At 8:55 p.m. Central Time, CNN and CBS took Florida out of the Gore column. All the others followed. Laura and I followed the returns from the mansion with Mother, Dad, Jeb, and several top aides. Eventually, the Cheneys, Don Evans, and a contingent of other close friends arrived. As the night went on, it became apparent that the outcome of the election would turn on Florida. At 1:15 in the morning, the networks called the state again, this time for me. Al Gore called shortly after that. He congratulated me graciously and said, "We sure gave them a cliffhanger." I thanked him and said I was headed out to address the 20,000 hardy souls freezing in the rain at the state capitol. He asked that I wait until he spoke to his supporters in about 15 minutes. I agreed. It took time for the meaning of the news to sink in. A few hours earlier, I had been getting ready to move on with my life. Now I was preparing to be president of the United States. 15 minutes passed. Then another 15. Still, no concession speech from Gore. Something was wrong. Jeb got on his laptop and started monitoring the Florida returns. He said my margin was narrowing. At 2:30, Bill Daley, Gore's campaign chairman, called Don Evans. Don spoke to Daley briefly and handed me the phone. The vice president was on the line. He told me his numbers in Florida had changed since the last call, and thus he was retracting his concession. I had never heard of a candidate unconceding. I told him that in Texas it meant something when a person gave you his word. "You don't have to get snippy about it," he replied. Soon after, the networks put Florida back into the undecided category, their fourth position in 8 hours, and threw the outcome of the election into question. I don't know about snippy, but I was hot. Just when I thought this wild race had ended, we were back at the starting gate. Several folks in the living room advised that I go out and declare victory. I considered it until Jeb pulled me aside and said, "George, don't do it. The count is too close." The margin in Florida had dwindled to fewer than 2,000 votes. Jeb was right. An attempt to force the issue would have been rash. I told everyone that the election would not be decided that night. Most went to bed. I stayed up with Jeb and Don as they worked the phones to Florida. At one point, Don called the Florida Secretary of State, Catherine Harris, to get an update. I heard him yell, "What do you mean you were in bed? Do you understand that the election is in the balance? What's going on?" With that, a strange night ended, and an even stranger 5 weeks began. Of the 105 million ballots cast nationwide, the 2000 election would be determined by several hundred votes in one state. Florida immediately turned into a legal battlefield. Don Evans learned around 4:30 a.m. that Gore's campaign had dispatched a team of lawyers to coordinate a recount. He advised me to do the same. I was confronted with the most bizarre personnel choice of my public life. Whom to send to Florida to ensure that our lead was protected? There was no time to develop a list or conduct interviews. Don suggested James Baker. Baker was the perfect choice, a statesman, a savvy lawyer, and a magnet for talented people. I called Jim and asked if he would take on the mission. Shortly thereafter, he was bound for Tallahassee. Laura and I were mentally and physically worn out. We had poured every ounce of our energy into the race. Once it became clear we were in for a lengthy legal process, we spent most of our time decompressing at our ranch in Crawford. I first saw Prairie Chapel Ranch in February 1998. I had always wanted a place to call my own, a refuge from the busy life, as Dad had in Kennebunkport. When I sold my stake in the Rangers, Laura and I had money to make a purchase. I was hooked the moment I saw Benny Engelbrecht's 1,583-acre place in McLennan County, almost exactly halfway between Austin and Dallas. The ranch was a combination of flat country suited for cattle grazing and rugged canyons that drained into the middle fork of the Bosque River and Rainy Creek. The view of the limestone cliffs from the bottom of the 90-foot canyons was stunning. So were the trees. Huge native pecans, live oaks, cedar elms, bur oaks, and bodark trees with their green fruits. In all, the place had over a dozen varieties of hardwoods, a rarity for Central Texas. To win over Laura, I promised to build a home and new roads to access the most scenic parts of the ranch. She found a young architect from the University of Texas named David Heyman, who designed a comfortable one-story house with large windows, each offering a unique view of our property. He utilized geothermal heat and recycled water to minimize the impact on the environment. Most of the construction took place during 2000. Surviving a presidential campaign and a home-building project in the same year is the mark of one strong marriage and a tribute to the patience and skill of Laura Bush. The ranch was the perfect place to ride out the post-election storm. I checked in regularly with Jim Baker to get updates and provide strategic direction. I decided early on that I would avoid the endless, breathless TV coverage. Instead, I took long runs that gave me a chance to think about the future. Burned off nervous energy by clearing cedar trees that guzzled water needed by the native hardwoods, and went for hikes by the creek with Laura. If I became president, I wanted to be energized and ready for the transition. There were some moments of high drama along the way. On December 8th, 1 month and 1 day after the election, Laura and I were back in Austin. That afternoon, the Florida Supreme Court was scheduled to hand down a decision that Jim Baker was confident would make my victory official. Laura and I invited our good friends Ben and Julie Crenshaw to watch the announcement. Ben is one of the most accomplished golfers of his era and one of the most likable people in professional sports. For the past few weeks, Gentle Ben had joined crowds protesting outside the governor's mansion. Some were Gore supporters, but many backed me. One of Ben and Julie's three young daughters carried a poster emblazoned with the words, "Sore Loser Man," a play on the Gore-Lieberman ticket. Ben had a homemade pink sign that read, "Florida, no more mulligans." Ben, Julie, Laura, and I gathered in the living room to await the ruling. I broke my no-TV rule in the hope that I could experience victory in real time. Around 3 o'clock, the court spokesman walked to the lectern. I prepared to embrace Laura. Then he announced that the court, by a 4-3 vote, had ruled for Gore. The decision mandated a statewide manual recount, yet another mulligan. Shortly thereafter, Jim Baker called to ask if I wanted to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. He and Ted Olson, an outstanding lawyer Jim had recruited, felt we had a strong case. They explained that appealing the decision was a risky move. The U.S. Supreme Court might not agree to hear the case, or they could rule against us. I told Jim to make the appeal. I was prepared to accept my fate. The country needed closure, one way or the other. On December 12th, 35 days after the election, Laura and I were lying in bed when Carl called and insisted that we turn on the TV. I listened intently as Pete Williams of NBC News deciphered the Supreme Court's verdict. By a vote of 7-2, the justices found that Florida's chaotic, inconsistent recount procedure had violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. Then, by a vote of 5-4, the court ruled that there was no fair way to recount the votes in time for Florida to participate in the Electoral College. The election results would stand. By a tally of 2,912,790 to 2,912,253, I had won Florida. I would be the 43rd president of the United States. My first response was relief. The uncertainty had inflicted a heavy toll on the country. After all the ups and downs, I didn't have the emotional capacity to rejoice. I had hoped to share my victory with 20,000 people at the state capitol on election night. Instead, I probably became the first person to learn he had won the presidency while lying in bed with his wife, watching TV. For the first 140 years of American history, presidential inaugurations were held on March 4th. A president, elected in early November, had about 120 days to prepare for his administration. In 1933, the 20th Amendment changed Inauguration Day to January 20th, shortening the average transition to about 75 days. When the 2000 election was finally resolved in Bush v. Gore, I had 38 days. My first big decision was how I wanted the White House to function. That was a question I had pondered before. In 1991, Dad asked me to study the operation of his White House. After interviewing all his senior staffers, a common theme emerged. People were dissatisfied. Most felt that Chief of Staff John Sununu had denied them access to the Oval Office and limited the flow of information to Dad. I had always liked John, but my job was not to debate the case. It was to report the findings. I did so several days before Thanksgiving of 1991. Dad concluded that he needed to make a change. He asked me to notify John, which I did in an awkward conversation. He submitted his resignation shortly thereafter. I was determined to avoid that problem in my White House. I wanted a structure that was tight enough to ensure an orderly flow of information, but flexible enough that I could receive advice from a variety of sources. It was important that advisors felt free to express concerns to me directly without passing through a filter. Plus, it would be easier to convince key members of my Texas political family to move to Washington if they would have regular access to me. The key to creating this structure was to hire an experienced, confident chief of staff who would not feel threatened by my relationships with his subordinates. Ironically, I found the perfect man in John Sununu's deputy, Andy Card. When I visited Dad's White House, I would often kick back in Andy's office to get a candid update on how things were going. Andy was perceptive, humble, loyal, and hardworking. He had served under every chief of staff during both the Reagan and Bush presidencies. He had the sound judgment and steady temperament I needed, along with a caring heart and a good sense of humor. I was convinced he was the right person to lead my White House staff. A couple of weeks before the election, I met discreetly with Andy in Florida. It was clear he thought I was asking him to lead the transition. "No, I'm talking about the big one," I said. I explained that he would be the only chief of staff, but that I would also rely heavily on Texans like Carl, Karen, Al Gonzalez, Harriet Myers, Clay Johnson, and Dan Bartlett for advice. Andy agreed to the job, so long as I informed him of any decisions I made outside his presence. I announced his selection in late November, making him the first official member of my White House team. The next important position to fill was National Security Advisor. I knew from watching Dad's close relationship with Brent Scowcroft that it was crucial to find someone highly capable and completely trustworthy. On a trip to Maine in the summer of 1998, Dad introduced me to Condoleezza Rice, who had served as a Soviet specialist on his National Security Council staff. The daughter of an African-American minister from segregated Birmingham, Alabama, Condi had a Ph.D. from the University of Denver and had become provost of Stanford at age 38. She immediately struck me as a smart, thoughtful, energetic woman. Over the next 2.5 years, Condi and I met frequently to discuss foreign policy. One summer day in 1999, Condi, Laura, and I were hiking on the ranch. As we started to climb up a steep grade, Condi launched into a discourse on the history of the Balkans. Laura and I were huffing and puffing. Condi kept going, explaining the disintegration of Yugoslavia and the rise of Milosevic. That trail is now known as Balkan Hill. I decided that if I ended up in the Oval Office, I wanted Condi Rice by my side. The first selection for the cabinet was easy. Colin Powell would be Secretary of State. I had first met Colin at Camp David in 1989, when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He and Dick Cheney had come to brief Dad on the surrender of Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega. Colin was wearing his army uniform. In contrast to the formality of his dress, he was good-natured and friendly. He spoke to everyone in the room, even bystanders like the president's children. Colin was widely admired at home and had a huge presence around the world. He would credibly defend American interests and values, from a stronger NATO to freer trade. I believed Colin could be the second coming of George Marshall, a soldier turned statesman. The two key national security positions left were Secretary of Defense and Director of Central Intelligence. More than a decade after the Berlin Wall fell, much of the Defense Department was still designed for fighting the Cold War. I had campaigned on an ambitious vision to transform the military. I planned to realign our force structure and invest in new technologies such as precision weapons and missile defense. I knew there would be resistance within the Pentagon, and I needed a tenacious, innovative secretary to lead the effort. My top candidate was Fred Smith, the founder and chief executive of FedEx. Fred graduated from Yale 2 years ahead of me, earned the Silver Star as a Marine in Vietnam, and built his company into one of the world's most successful businesses. He loved the military and would bring an organizational mind to the Pentagon. Andy Card called Fred, learned he was interested in the job, and invited him to Austin. I was prepared to offer Fred the position, but before he made the trip, he was diagnosed with a heart condition. He had to bow out to focus on his health. We considered a variety of other names for Secretary of Defense, including Dan Coats, a fine senator from Indiana. Then Condi threw out an interesting idea. How about Don Rumsfeld? Don had been Secretary of Defense 25 years earlier, during the Ford administration. He had since served on a number of influential national security commissions. I had been considering Rumsfeld for CIA, not defense. When I interviewed him, Don laid out a captivating vision for transforming the Defense Department. He talked about making our forces lighter, more agile, and more rapidly deployable. And he was a strong proponent of a missile defense system to protect against rogue states like North Korea and Iran. Rumsfeld impressed me. He was knowledgeable, articulate, and confident. As a former Secretary of Defense, he had the strength and experience to bring major changes to the Pentagon. He would run the bureaucracy, not let it run him. Dick Cheney, who had been Don's deputy when he was Chief of Staff in the Ford White House, recommended him strongly. There was one awkward issue. Some believed that Don had used his influence to persuade President Ford to appoint Dad to run the CIA in 1975 as a way of taking him out of contention for the vice presidency. I had no way of knowing if this was true. But whatever disagreements he and Dad might have had 25 years earlier did not concern me, so long as Don could do the job. Don went on to become both the youngest and oldest person to serve as Secretary of Defense. With Rumsfeld going to the Pentagon, I no longer had a leading candidate for the CIA. I had great respect for the agency as a result of Dad's time there. I had been receiving intelligence briefings as president-elect for a few weeks when I met the sitting director, George Tenet. He was the opposite of the stereotypical CIA director you read about in spy novels, the bow-tied Ivy League elite type. Tenet was a blue-collar guy, the son of Greek immigrants from New York City. He spoke bluntly, often colorfully, and obviously cared deeply about the agency. Retaining Bill Clinton's CIA director would send a message of continuity and show that I considered the agency beyond the reach of politics. I asked Dad to sound out some of his CIA contacts. He told me Tenet was highly respected within the ranks. As George and I got to know each other, I decided to stop looking for a replacement. The cigar-chomping, Greek-to-the-core director agreed to stay. For the most part, the national security team functioned smoothly in the early years of the administration. The economic team did not. The problem was partly the result of a personnel mismatch. As president, I had three economic advisors: the National Economic Council director, the Council of Economic Advisers chairman, and the Secretary of the Treasury. I chose Larry Lindsey, an accomplished economist and senior advisor on my campaign, to lead the NEC. Glenn Hubbard, another thoughtful economist, chaired the CEA. They did a fine job designing the tax cuts I had proposed during the campaign. The legislation passed with a strong bipartisan majority. My Treasury Secretary did not share the same enthusiasm for tax cuts. Paul O'Neill had come recommended by Dick, Clay Johnson, and others on the team. His strong resume included success at the Office of Management and Budget, and as the CEO of Alcoa, a Fortune 100 company. I felt that his practical business experience would command respect on Wall Street and Capitol Hill. Unfortunately, things started going wrong from the start. Paul belittled the tax cuts, which of course got back to me. He and I met regularly but never clicked. He didn't gain my confidence, nor did he build credibility with the financial community, Congress, or his colleagues in the administration. I was hoping for a strong Treasury Secretary, a leader like Jim Baker or Bob Rubin, who would advance my economic policies in speeches and on TV. By late 2002, nearly 2 million Americans had lost jobs in the past year, and Paul wasn't conveying our determination to get them back to work. Instead, he used his meetings in the Oval Office to talk about tangential topics, like his plan to improve workplace safety at the U.S. Mint. I did not want to repeat Dad's mistake of 1992, when he was perceived as disengaged on the economy. I decided that a shakeup of the economic team was the best way to signal that my administration was serious about confronting the slowdown affecting everyday Americans. For the change to be credible, it had to be sweeping. Larry Lindsey had done a fine job, and it was not easy to ask him to move on. He understood the need for a fresh start and handle the news professionally. Paul did not take it as well. I was disappointed that he departed on bad terms, but glad I made the decision when I did. The next summer, I received a surprising invitation to make another change. Every week, Dick Cheney and I ate lunch together. Just the two of us. Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale had started the tradition, and it had continued ever since. I liked the relaxed setting and the chance to hear whatever Dick had on his mind. While I had similar meetings with other top aides, Dick was the only one on a regular schedule. I didn't look at the vice president as another senior advisor. He had put his name on the ballot and gotten elected. I wanted him to be comfortable with all the issues on my desk. After all, it could become his at any moment. Dick and I ate in a small dining room off the Oval Office. The room's decorations included a bronze bull sculpture, given to me by some East Texas friends, and a landscape painting that reminded me of the Maine coast. The dominant piece of art in the room was a portrait of John Quincy Adams, the only other son of a president to hold the office. I hung it as an inside joke with Dad. One day early in my presidency, he was teasing me about the special kinship between W and Q. I wanted him to have to look Q in the face the next time he felt the urge to needle. I had read a fair amount about Quincy. I admired his abolitionist principles, although I wasn't crazy about his campaign to exclude Texas from the Union. Nevertheless, I kept the portrait up for the rest of my time in the White House. In mid-2003, Dick opened one of our weekly lunches with a startling comment. He said, "Mr. President, I want you to know that you should feel free to run for re-election with someone else. No hard feelings." I asked about his health. He said his heart was fine. He just thought I should have the option to refashion the ticket. His offer impressed me. It was so atypical in power-hungry Washington. It confirmed the reasons I'd picked Dick in the first place. I did consider his offer. I talked to Andy, Carl, and a few others about the possibility of asking Bill Frist, the impressive Tennessee senator who had become majority leader, to run with me instead. We all expected 2004 to bring another close election. While Dick helped with important parts of our base, he had become a lightning rod for criticism from the media and the left. He was seen as dark and heartless, the Darth Vader of the administration. Dick didn't care about his image, which I liked, but that allowed the caricatures to stick. One myth was that Dick was actually running the White House. Everyone inside the building, including the vice president, knew that was not true, but the impression was out there. Accepting Dick's offer would be one way to demonstrate that I was in charge. The more I thought about it, the more strongly I felt Dick should stay. I hadn't picked him to be a political asset. I had chosen him to help me do the job. That was exactly what he had done. He accepted any assignment I asked. He gave me his unvarnished opinion. He understood that I made the final decisions. When we disagreed, he kept our differences private. Most important, I trusted Dick. I valued his steadiness. I enjoyed being around him. And he had become a good friend. At one of our lunches a few weeks later, I asked Dick to stay. And he agreed. As the 2004 election approached, I grew concerned about the growing discord within the national security team. In most administrations, there is a natural friction between the diplomats at state and the warriors at defense. Secretary of State George Shultz and Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger famously battled throughout the Reagan administration. President Ford replaced Defense Secretary James Schlesinger largely because he couldn't get along with Henry Kissinger. I didn't mind some creative tension in the organization. Differences of opinion among advisors helped clarify tough decisions. The key was that disagreements had to be aired respectfully, and my decisions had to be accepted as final. After the successful liberation of Afghanistan, the territorial squabbles between state and defense seemed tolerable. But when the debate over Iraq intensified, high-level officials within the respective departments started sniping at each other viciously. Colin and Don were always respectful to each other in my presence. Over time, I realized they were like a pair of old duelers who kept their own pistols in their holsters, but let their seconds and thirds fire away. A memorable example came during one of Don Rumsfeld's televised press briefings, which he had been holding almost daily since the war in Afghanistan started. Don's handling of the press was fun to watch. He was an expert at parrying reporters' questions, and he jousted with exuberance and flair. I liked to tease him about his stardom in the early afternoon TV slot. "You're a matinee idol for the over 60 crowd," I told him. He took the ribbing in stride. In January 2003, a Dutch television reporter asked Don why America's European allies were not more supportive of our calls to hold Saddam Hussein to account. "You're thinking of Europe as Germany and France," Don said. "I don't. I think that's old Europe." I agreed with Don's point. The new democracies of Central and Eastern Europe understood the nightmare of tyranny firsthand and supported action against Saddam Hussein. But that sensible argument is not what made the news. Don's characterization of Germany and France as old Europe ignited a wave of protest. Colin was furious. He was trying to persuade the Germans and French to join our cause at the United Nations, and he felt Don had crossed into his lane in a way that complicated his diplomatic mission. His subordinates clearly felt the same way. Policy disputes that once took place behind closed doors started spilling out in the press. It irritated me to read headlines like, "A White House Divided," "The Bush Administration's Civil War," and "Bush's Next Role? Mediator in Disputes Over Running Post-War Iraq." I announced at NSC meetings that the squabbling and leaks were damaging our credibility and giving ammunition to our critics. I spoke to Don and Colin individually. I asked Dick and Condi to work behind the scenes. I instructed Condi's skillful deputy, Steve Hadley, to tell the seconds and thirds to cool it. Nothing worked. In the spring of 2004, Don came to me with serious news. In defiance of their orders and military law, American soldiers had severely mistreated detainees at an Iraqi prison called Abu Ghraib. I felt sick, really sick. This was not what our military or our country stood for. While the perpetrators were court-martialed, America's reputation took a severe hit. I considered it a low point in my presidency. I also felt blindsided. Don had told me the military was investigating reports of abuse at the prison, but I had no idea how graphic or grotesque the photos would be. The first time I saw them was the day they were aired by 60 Minutes 2. I was not happy with the way the situation had been handled. Neither was the team at the White House. People started talking to the press and pointing fingers, mostly at my Secretary of Defense. When Don got word of the stories, he gave me a handwritten note. "Mr. President, I want you to know that you have my resignation as Secretary of Defense anytime you feel it would be helpful to you." I called Don that night and told him I would not accept his resignation. I didn't blame him for the misconduct of the soldiers at Abu Ghraib, and I didn't want to turn him into a scapegoat. I needed the problem fixed, and I wanted him to do it. 4 days later, Don sent another, longer letter. He wrote, "During recent days, I have given a good deal of thought to the situation, testified before Congress, and considered your views. I have great respect for you, your outstanding leadership in the global war on terror, and your hopes for our country. However, I have concluded that the damage from the acts of abuse that happened on my watch, by individuals for whose conduct I am ultimately responsible, can best be responded to by my resignation." I respected Don for repeating his offer. It was clear his earlier message had not been a mere formality. He was serious about leaving. It was a testament to his character, his loyalty to the office, and his understanding of the damage Abu Ghraib was causing. I seriously considered accepting his advice. I knew it would send a powerful signal to replace the leader of the Pentagon after such a grave mistake. But a big factor held me back. There was no obvious replacement for Don, and I couldn't afford to create a vacuum at the top of defense. While I decided not to accept Don's resignation, the spring of 2004 marked the end of my tolerance for the squabbling within the national security team. What started as creative tension had turned destructive. The stories about the feuds were fueling the impression of disarray within the administration, and making me furious. I concluded that the animosity was so deeply embedded that the only solution was to change the entire national security team after the 2004 election. Colin Powell made it easier for me. That same spring of 2004, he told me he was ready to move on. He had served 3 tough years and was naturally fatigued. He was also a sensitive man who had been wounded by the infighting and discouraged by the failure to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I asked Colin to stay through the election, and I was grateful that he agreed. The early notification gave me plenty of time to think about a successor. I admired Colin, but it sometimes seemed like the State Department he led wasn't fully on board with my philosophy and policies. It was important to me that there be no daylight between the President and the Secretary of State. After 6 years together in the White House and on the campaign, I'd grown very close to Condi Rice. She could read my mind and my moods. We shared a vision of the world, and she wasn't afraid to let me know when she disagreed with me. Condi's range of talents was impressive. I had watched her brief members of Congress and the press on sensitive national security issues. She was a talented pianist who had played with Yo-Yo Ma. She inspired people with her story of growing up in the segregated South, and she knew how to handle some of the biggest personalities in the world. I saw that in March 2001, when I held a meeting on North Korea policy to prepare for my visit the next day with South Korean President Kim Dae-jung, my first with an Asian head of state. The previous administration had offered concessions to North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il in return for a pledge to abandon his nuclear weapons program. The policy had not worked, and I told the team we were going to change it. From then on, North Korea would have to change its behavior before America made concessions. At 5:15 the next morning, I read the Washington Post. One story opened, "The Bush administration intends to pick up where the Clinton administration left off in negotiations with North Korea over its missile programs," Secretary of State Colin L. Powell said yesterday. I was stunned. I figured the reporter must have misquoted Colin, because the story was the exact opposite of what we had discussed at the meeting. I called Condi. Like me, she is an early riser, but she had not yet seen the paper. I gave her a summary of the Post story and said, "By the time Colin gets to the White House for the meeting, this had better be fixed." I had given Condi a daunting assignment. She had to instruct the Secretary of State, a world-famous former general a generation older than she, to correct his quote. Later that morning, Colin came bounding into the Oval Office and said, "Mr. President, don't worry. It's all been cleared up." The next year, I asked Condi to take on a similar mission with the Vice President. It was August 2002, and I was thinking through my decision on whether to seek a UN resolution to send weapons inspectors back to Iraq. Dick gave a speech at the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention in which he said, "A return of inspectors would provide false comfort that Saddam was somehow back in his box." That made it sound like my decision had been made, but I was still considering my options. I asked Condi to make clear to Dick that he had gotten out in front of my position. She made the call, and to Dick's credit, it never happened again. I prepared to announce Condi's nomination as Secretary of State shortly after the 2004 election. To fill the National Security Advisor post, I decided to promote her outstanding deputy, Steve Hadley, a humble and thoughtful lawyer whose advice was always crisp, discreet, and uncolored by any personal agenda. Then, out of nowhere, Andy informed me that Colin had expressed second thoughts about leaving. I considered Colin a friend and appreciated his achievements, especially his work to rally a strong coalition in the war on terror and lay the groundwork for future peace between the Israelis and Palestinians. But I had already decided on Condi. I've always wondered if one of the reasons Colin hesitated to leave is that he expected Don Rumsfeld to go too. He was right to assume that. I had planned to make a change at defense as part of a new national security team. Late in 2004, I asked Andy to approach Fred Smith again to see if he would consider the job. I had seen Fred, and he looked perfectly fine. The problem this time was not Fred's health. It was his oldest daughter's. Wendy had been born with a fatal genetic heart condition, and he needed to spend time with her. Sadly, she died in 2005. I considered other possible replacements at defense. I thought about sending Condi to the Pentagon, but I decided she would be a better Secretary of State. I considered Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, but I didn't think he was the right fit either. At one point, I reached out to Jim Baker. Had he accepted, Jim could have claimed a historic triple crown as the first person ever to serve as Secretary of State, Treasury, and Defense. But he was enjoying his retirement and had no interest in returning to Washington. The reality is, there aren't many people capable of leading the military during a complex global war. Don Rumsfeld was one of the few. He had valuable experience and shared my view of the war on terror as a long-term ideological struggle. At times, Don frustrated me with his abruptness toward military leaders and members of my staff. I felt he'd made a mistake by skipping the retirement ceremony of General Eric Shinseki, the 4-star Army Chief of Staff who stepped down in 2003 after an honorable career. Don's decision helped feed the false impression that the general had been fired for policy disagreements over Iraq. Still, I liked Don. He respected the chain of command. He and his wife Joyce devoted themselves to our troops and frequently visited military hospitals without seeking press attention. Don was doing a superb job transforming the military, the mission that initially attracted me to him. He had increased our arsenal of unmanned aerial vehicles, made our forces more expeditionary, expanded the military's broadband capacity so we could make better use of real-time data links and imagery, begun bringing home troops from former Cold War outposts such as Germany, and invested heavily in the special forces, especially in the integration of intelligence and special operations. Despite his tough external veneer, Don Rumsfeld was a decent and caring man. One day he and I were in the Oval Office. He had just finished briefing me on a military operation, and I had a few minutes before my next meeting. I asked casually how his family was doing. He did not answer at first. Eventually, he got out a few words, but then he broke down in tears. He explained to me that his son Nick was battling a serious drug addiction. Don's pain was deep, his love genuine. Months later, I asked how Nick was doing. Don beamed as he explained that his son had gone through rehab and was well. It was touching to see Don's pride in his son's character and strength. I felt for Don again in the spring of 2006, when a group of retired generals launched a barrage of public criticism against him. While I was still considering a personnel change, there was no way I was going to let a group of retired officers bully me into pushing out the civilian Secretary of Defense. It would have looked like a military coup and would have set a disastrous precedent. As 2006 wore on, the situation in Iraq worsened dramatically. Sectarian violence was tearing the country apart. In the early fall, Don told me he thought we might need fresh eyes on the problem. I agreed that change was needed, especially since I was seriously contemplating a new strategy, the surge. But I was still struggling to find a capable replacement. One evening in the fall of 2006, I was chatting with my high school and college friend Jack Morrison, whom I had appointed to the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, PFIAB. I was worried about the deteriorating conditions in Iraq and mentioned Don Rumsfeld's comment about needing fresh eyes. "I have an idea," Jack said. "What about Bob Gates?" He told me he had met with Gates recently as part of his PFIAB work. Why hadn't I thought of Bob? He had been CIA director in Dad's administration and deputy national security advisor to President Reagan. He had successfully run a large organization, Texas A&M University. He served on the Baker-Hamilton Commission, which was studying the problems in Iraq. He would be ideal for the job. I immediately called Steve Hadley and asked him to feel out Bob. We had tried to recruit him as Director of National Intelligence the previous year, but he had declined because he loved his job as President of A&M. Steve reported back the next day. Bob was interested. I was pretty sure I had found the right person for the job, but I was concerned about the timing. We were weeks away from the 2006 midterm elections. If I were to change defense secretaries at that point, it would look like I was making military decisions with politics in mind. I decided to make the move after the election. The weekend before the midterms, Bob drove from College Station, Texas, to the ranch in Crawford. We met in my office, a secluded one-story building about a half mile from the main house. I felt comfortable around Bob. He is a straightforward, unassuming man with a quiet strength. I promised him access to me any time he needed it. Then I told him there was something else he needed to know before taking the job. I was seriously considering a troop increase in Iraq. He was open to it. I told him I knew he had a great life at A&M, but his country needed him. He accepted the job on the spot. I knew Dick would not be happy with my decision. He was a close friend of Don's. As always, Dick told me what he thought. "I disagree with your decision. I think Don is doing a fine job. But it's your call. You're the president." I asked Dick to deliver the news to his friend, which I hope would soften the blow. Don handled the change like the professional he is. He sent me a touching letter. "I leave with great respect for you and for the leadership you have provided during a most challenging time for our country," he wrote. "It has been the highest honor of my long life to have been able to serve our country at such a critical time in our history." Replacing the Secretary of Defense was one of two difficult personnel changes I made in 2006. The other was changing chiefs of staff. With the environment in Washington turning sour, Andy Card reminded me often that there were only a handful of positions in which a personnel move would be viewed as significant. His job was one of them. In early 2006, Andy often brought up the possibility of his departure. "You can do it easily, and it could change the debate," he said. "You owe it to yourself to consider it." Around the same time, Clay Johnson asked to see me. Clay had served with me every day since I took office as governor in 1995. When we sat down for lunch that day, he asked me how I thought the White House was functioning. I told him I was a little unsettled. I had been hearing complaints from staff members. From the perch of the presidency, though, it was hard to tell whether the gripes were petty grievances or evidence of a serious problem. Clay gave me a look that showed there wasn't much doubt in his mind. Then he pulled a pen out of his pocket, picked up his napkin, and sketched the organizational chart of the White House. It was a tangled mess, with lines of authority crossing and blurred. His point was clear. This was a major source of the unrest. Then he said, "I am not the only one who feels this way." He told me that several people had spontaneously used the same unflattering term to describe the White House structure. It started with cluster and ended with four more letters. Clay was right. The organization was drifting. People had settled into comfort zones, and the sharpness that had once characterized our operation had dulled. The most effective way to fix the problem was to make a change at the top. I decided it was time to take Andy up on his offer to move on. The realization was painful. Andy Card was a loyal, honorable man who led the White House effectively through trying days. On a trip to Camp David that spring, I went to see Andy and his wife, Kathy, at the bowling alley. They are one of those great couples whose love for each other is so obvious. They knew I wasn't there for bowling. My face must have betrayed my anguish. I started by thanking Andy for his service. He cut me off and said, "Mr. President, you want to make a change?" I tried to explain. He wouldn't let me. We hugged, and he said he accepted my decision. I was uncomfortable creating any large vacancy without having a replacement lined up. So before I had my talk with Andy, I had asked Josh Bolton to come see me. I respected Josh a lot, and so did his colleagues. Since his days as policy director of my campaign, he had served as deputy chief of staff for policy and director of the Office of Management and Budget. He knew my priorities as well as anyone. My trust in him was complete. When I asked Josh if he would be my next chief of staff, he did not jump at the offer. Like most of the White House, he admired Andy Card and knew how hard the job could be. After thinking about it, he agreed that the White House needed restructuring and refreshing. He told me that if he took the job, he expected a green light to make personnel changes and clarify lines of authority and responsibility. I told him that was precisely why I wanted him. He accepted the job and stayed to the end, which made him one of the first staffers I hired for my campaign and the last I saw in the Oval Office, with 10 full years in between. Shortly after taking over, Josh moved forward with a number of changes, including replacing the White House press secretary with Tony Snow, a witty former TV and radio host who became a dear friend until he lost his valiant battle with cancer in 2008. The trickiest move was redefining Carl's role. After the 2004 election, Andy had asked Carl to become deputy chief of staff for policy, the top policy position in the White House. I understood his rationale. Carl is more than a political advisor. He is a policy wonk with a passion for knowledge and for turning ideas into action. I approved his promotion because I wanted to benefit from Carl's expertise and abilities. To avoid any misperceptions, Andy made clear that Carl would not be included in national security meetings. By the middle of 2006, Republicans were in trouble in the upcoming midterm elections, and the left had unfairly used Carl's new role to accuse us of politicizing policy decisions. Josh asked Carl to focus on the midterms and continue to provide strategic input. To take over the day-to-day policy operations, Josh brought in his deputy from OMB, Joel Kaplan, a brilliant and personable Harvard Law graduate who had worked for me since 2000. I worried about how Carl would interpret the move. He had developed a thick skin in Washington, but he was a proud, sensitive man who had absorbed savage attacks on my behalf. It was a tribute to Carl's loyalty and Josh's managerial skill that they made the new arrangement work until Carl left the White House in August 2007. While White House staff and cabinet appointments are crucial to decision-making, they are temporary. Judicial appointments are for life. I knew how proud Dad was to have appointed Clarence Thomas, a wise, principled, humane man. I also knew he was disappointed that his other nominee, David Souter, had evolved into a different kind of judge than he expected. History is full of similar tales. John Adams famously called Chief Justice John Marshall, who served on the bench for 30 years after Adams left office, his greatest gift to the American people. On the other hand, when Dwight Eisenhower was asked to name his biggest mistakes as president, he answered, "I made two, and they're both sitting on the Supreme Court." Shortly after the 2000 election was decided, I asked my White House counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, and his team of lawyers to develop a list of candidates for the Supreme Court. Al was an impressive second-generation American who had worked his way through Rice University and Harvard Law School and earned my trust when I was governor. I told him the Supreme Court list should include women, minorities, and people with no previous experience on the bench. I made clear there should be no political litmus test. The only tests in my mind were personal integrity, intellectual ability, and judicial restraint. I was concerned about activist judges who substituted their personal preferences for the text of the law. I subscribed to the strict constructionist school. I wanted judges who believed the Constitution meant what it said. For more than 11 years, the same 9 justices had sat together on the court, the longest such streak in modern history. On June 30th, 2005, Harriet Myers, who had replaced Al Gonzalez as White House counsel when he became Attorney General, was informed that the Supreme Court would be forwarding a letter for me from one of the justices. We all assumed it was from Chief Justice William Rehnquist, who was 80 years old and sick. But the next morning, Harriet called me with a surprise. "It's O'Connor," she said. I had met Justice Sandra Day O'Connor many times over the years. The first female justice in the history of the court, she had an engaging, straightforward personality. I was fond of Sandra and called her immediately after I received her letter. She told me it was time for her to go take care of her beloved husband John, who was suffering from Alzheimer's. While the vacancy was not the one I expected, we were prepared to fill it. Harriet's team prepared a thick binder that contained the biographies of 11 candidates, as well as detailed analyses of their writings, speeches, and judicial philosophies. I had a trip to Europe scheduled in early July, and the long hours on Air Force One made for good reading time. After studying the binder, I narrowed the list down to 5 impressive judges: Samuel Alito, Edith Brown Clement, Michael Luttig, John Roberts, and J. Harvey Wilkinson. Each came to meet me in the White House residence. I tried to put them at ease by giving them a tour of the living area. Then I took them to the family sitting room that overlooks the West Wing. I had read the summaries of their legal opinions. Now I wanted to read the